It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Kudos to Jillian Van Stratt, who's a reporter for MLive. I have really enjoyed this morning her photo montage. This is headlined, A Look at 10 Memorable Moments in the Career of Retiring Detroit Tigers Manager Jim Leyland. Here is Leyland high-fiving President Bill Clinton at the White House after he took the Pittsburgh Pirates, or the, the Florida Marlins to the World Series and winning it all back in 97, I want to say. Here's also one I hadn't seen before. Here is Leland and Barry Bonds in an angry confrontation. This is when Bonds played for Pittsburgh and Leland was the manager. Some angry confrontation between the two at training camp in Bradenton, Florida, 1991. And there's a lot here as the Tigers skipper too, as well. But check it out, Jillian Van Stratt, MLive. At the top of our program here today, driving around Grand Rapids or Kalamazoo or suburban Detroit, you're apt to see an interesting new billboard. Alongside smiling, ethnically diverse faces, the boards read, Millions of Americans are living happily without religion. The billboards and a related website are the work of the secular organization, the Center for Inquiry, which is based in New York. Members of the group, including our next guest, say the purpose of the campaign is to connect with what polls suggest is a growing number of Americans not affiliated with any religion. Jennifer Behan is the assistant director of the Michigan chapter of the Center for Inquiry. She joins us to talk about the campaign and her organization. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning, Mark.
Tell us more about what the Center for Inquiry does and what it stands for. Yeah. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello.
Oh, there you are.
Hey, sorry, we got cut off. Not sure what happened yet. I guess I got to be careful with this phone.
Okay.
So Center for Inquiry, we are a secular educational nonprofit, and our primary goal in our outreach programming, which is what my job is to help create communities for secular individuals who are not religious, whether they're atheist, agnostic, humanist, just secular, or they don't even use any term. But all of our events are open to people from all backgrounds, regardless of whether or not they're religious. So our main focus in our programming is educational events. We host lectures on the second and fourth Wednesdays in West Michigan, and occasionally in other areas throughout the state. But we started in West Michigan, and we're working on expanding our programming as we build up a member base throughout the rest of the state. And then we also have discussion groups for people to come and talk about current events and important ideas that are need to be discussed and people have questions about, anything from philosophy to beliefs, recent scientific findings, all kinds of things. And then we also provide social support through our Living Without Religion support groups. So some people who've been in religion, they have had a very difficult time, and some people's families are much more strict and rigorous with religious belief, and that can be psychologically damaging on some levels to certain people. So we have a support group for people to come and just talk about their experiences that they have as they're coming out of religion, or even if they've been out for a while, that, you know, things that have that bothered them from their past. And then the final thing we do is we do social events for our members, and that's basically just an excuse to get together and have a barbecue or go get a beer at one of the local pubs. Because, you know, we're social creatures. We just want to enjoy life and experience all the good things around us. So that's, you know, primarily what we do. And then, I guess, sorry, last one, service events. We have a very active service committee and service program, and we work with other area groups to help do service projects to help make our world better. Because part of the thing with being a secular person is we believe that this life that we have right now is the only one we have. There's no afterlife. There's no reincarnation. We don't have any promise of any life after the little short time we have here. So we want to make sure that we give back and to our communities and to the world and make the world as good of a place as we can for ourselves while we're here, and then also make sure that it is in the best shape we can to pass it on to our children and our grandchildren and their children. And so, you know, a lot of our stuff's based on, like, social support. We work with Kids Food Basket. We work with several environmental organizations to help, you know, clean up the rivers. What kind of stuff.
What kind of responses have you had to your billboards?
Well, the responses have been all over the board. And we had another billboard in 2011 that had a similar message again, the responses are all over the place. So the ones that we're most excited to see are the ones where people say, wow, CFI, I didn't even know you guys existed. This is fantastic. And so they come and they find our group and they actually can start being a part of our community, because one of the reasons, the primary reason for the billboard is to help secular people know that they're not alone.
Right. You know, create a community, as you put
right.
it.
Right. In Grand Rapids, you can drive down a street and there's a church on like every third or fourth corner. And if you're a secular person or, you know, you just have questions and you're not sure, there's no place that you can see where you can go. So we put up a billboard just to let people know, hey, we're here. You're not alone. And that is the primary purpose of the billboard. The secondary purpose of the billboard is to help people who may not understand what non-religious people believe, whether they're religious or non-religious, is to educate them and help dispel some of the negative stereotypes that have been around about religious people throughout centuries. So we want to just tell people that here's what we actually believe. Go to the website, watch this video, check out these statistics, look at these stories of our actual real live members, and find out what some secular people near you actually really believe. Because according to the most recent Pew poll, 1 in 5 people is not religiously unaffiliated, So that means they may still believe in some sort of spiritual God or something, but a lot of them don't. 6% of the whole group of people studied are completely secular, agnostic or atheist.
Well, your group has a fairly reasonable name, if I may use that term, the Center for Inquiry. Your billboards proclaim millions of Americans are living happily without religion. Is your organization more about inquiry, or is it more about eschewing religion?
It is more about inquiry. The name was chosen on purpose. We actually, when they started the Center for Inquiry, it grew out of two other organizations, the Committee for Secular Humanism and the Committee for Skeptical Investigations of the Claims of Paranormal. And so we had the skeptics on one side and we have the humanists on the other. And for a long time, people wouldn't even use the word atheist because they were afraid of it. So one of the things that we're trying to do is, yes, our mission is to foster secular society based on science, reason, freedom of inquiry, and humanist values. So we are trying to create a community where people can come together and inquire and have a forum to engage in these ideas and learn about the fascinating world around us. Now, we do talk about religion, but frankly, most of our members, once they get past that point where they've been out of religion for a little while and they've kind of gotten it off their chest of like venting of the things that they liked and they didn't like, we don't really like to talk about it anymore.
How much contact do you have with believers? I mean, and how do those encounters typically go?
I mean, me personally?
Yeah, or with other members of your organization.
Well, I have several friends who are religious and are in various different states of spirituality. I'm a very friendly person. I'll talk to anybody, and I think that they're entitled to their beliefs just like I'm entitled to mine. As long as we can have a reasonable discussion about it, then that's great. I certainly don't go up to people and try to like egg them on into a discussion about their beliefs, because you know, there's so many important things that we need to work together on, that if we're just talking about a particular Bible passage that we disagree on, that's only one small thing that we disagree on. We agree on so much more. So I'm the kind of person, I like to focus on what we can agree on so we can help make society and our world a better place. There are certainly those out there that like to, you know, pick apart theological claims and argue about them. But there's also Christians who like to do the same thing. So, you know, it's kind of to each their own. There are people in our group who engage in debates and dialogues with people about specific theological things, but my friends who do that are incredibly respectful, and they're actually very, very well known among believers for that. My husband and several of his friends who have studied theology for years run a podcast called Reasonable Doubts Podcast, and they actually have a very high number of people on their podcast who are religious because they like the guys, because even though they're actually like criticizing their particular beliefs they believe in, they're very respectful about it, and they do it based on evidence. And that's what we're trying to do at Center for Inquiry also. We want to create a forum where people can come and evaluate the evidence, and then they have to make their own decision based on critical thinking and weighing the pros and cons and what's the best for them and what's the best for everybody.
We're talking with Jennifer Behan, who's the Assistant Director of the Michigan Chapter for the Center for Inquiry. The organization has put a number of billboards up around Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, and suburban Detroit, proclaiming millions of Americans are living happily without religion. You know, Jennifer, I also read polls periodically that suggest that the larger world may be more religious than ever, that there are more, quote, religious people than ever before. What do you make of that? I mean, you've got the Pew poll findings, I realize that, but what about the larger world?
Yeah, I don't know. I know that, I don't know the exact statistics, so don't quote me on them, but I know that in some countries that some forms of Islam have been on the rise, and some Christian sects too. But generally, I would actually, if you would find that study, you asked me that question earlier, and I actually couldn't find anything that said that. All the ones that I came up with said that more people are non-religious than ever before, and and I know that like Pew and Gallup focus mostly on the United States and this side of the world. So I don't know. I would love to see the studies and understand why, because there are several countries in Europe that are like almost completely secular. up in Northern Europe especially. And so I that confused me when I saw that question, because all of the thing that I've been hearing is nuns are on the rise, the N-O-N-E-S, not the N-U-N-S's, especially among younger people, the numbers are as high as 1 in 3 being not religious.
How many? Third. I was curious about your comment earlier involving formerly religious people. How many of your members are formerly religious, and does your organization cater to people in that circumstance?
Well, we do. We have a lot of members who come out of religion, and there's kind of it's almost kind of like the stages of grief. So you get people who come out, especially people if they've been in really, really strict sects of religion, or even in a cult or different things like that, where they come out and they just need to like vent. And so that's why we have a support group for people who are at that stage. But then, once you've been out for a little bit, and especially if your family's supportive, or at least they're not negative towards you, because we do have members who have been banned from their families. We have members who cannot tell their parents that they're an atheist or agnostic for fear of like them never speaking to them again or taking their grandchildren away from them. Or we have several. We have a group of people who are ex-Muslim over in the Detroit area who one of them is totally out and is fine, and the other one can't. We have to use a pseudonym if we ever talk about him in public, because his family would shut him out. Mm. So they definitely need support, and we do provide support for that. But that's like, it's like a short time. Once they get past that, then they're beyond it. And then we focus on talking about like the positive things. And we host most of our lectures are on scientific research, new things that are coming out, important social issues. We do service projects so our members can go back out into the community and put their humanist values into action.
Very
and
good.
Give back to the people around them. And we just have, we do a summer retreat where we have over 100 people come to a campground here in central Michigan, and we just enjoy life. And so we provide a community for people that some may lose when they come out of religion, because either their community that they lived in or their family won't really accept them anymore, or it's awkward. They'll let them come, but it's just they don't feel like they can be themselves.
Okay, very good. Jennifer Behan, we appreciate you joining us today. Jennifer's the Assistant Director of the Michigan Chapter of the Center for Inquiry. Good luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Back in 2008, the Michigan legislature passed the state's Renewable Portfolio Standard. The law requires that by the year 2015, the state's electric utilities must generate at least 10% of their energy from renewable sources. As 2015 approaches, state officials are working to determine the next steps for Michigan's energy policy. Earlier this year, we spoke with Michigan Public Service Commission Chair John Quackenbush. At the time, John was holding public forums on the state's energy future. The information compiled at the forums and online are part of four comprehensive draft reports. The final draft is released today. We welcome back John Quackenbush to see what he's learned since starting this process. Hi, John.
It's great to join you today.
Thank you for rejoining us here. So regarding public comment here, what were some of the more prevalent concerns or questions citizens had over the renewable portfolio standard?
Well, we had a lot of comments about renewables. Certain citizens thought we should be doing a lot more. Some citizens thought we should be doing less. We are on track to hit the 10% by 2015 standard, and we're looking forward to the legislature making a decision about where we go beyond 2015.
And were there particular points that really rose to the top in your report and after all of these forums?
Well, we looked at the technical ability for Michigan to build more wind, and we found it is there. And we also looked at the cost. Wind is the least costly renewable currently, and pleasantly, we found that the cost of wind has declined from what it was contemplated in 2008. The thought was it would cost $100 or $110 per megawatt hour. Technology has advanced, and wind turbines are built better and more productive today. And we can generate electricity from them for $50 to $60 per megawatt hour. And even we've had one down in the 48 range.
Hmm. There was an extraordinary story, maybe you saw it, in Sunday's Free Press, which actually took a look at wind power in Michigan from an angle I was not expecting at all. And apparently some of these wind turbines have become tourist attractions in some parts of the state. Did you see that, or are you aware of that trend?
Yes. Yes, I know up in Ludington there's a regular tour that you can sign up for.
That's right.
to tour the wind farm up there and other ones we have in central Michigan or in the Thumb area, I don't know, have formally organized tours, but you can certainly drive through the countryside and see the turbines spinning.
Your draft report reads that Michigan could reasonably raise energy standards, requiring utilities to get 30% from renewable sources by 2035. What factors make 30% a feasible goal?
Well,
besides the wind, you've touched on the wind. What else is going on there that makes that a feasible goal?
Well, one of the prevalent comments we received about wind is that it is intermittent in nature in terms of providing power. It's not like a plant that you can turn off and on at will. It operates when the wind blows, and it doesn't when the wind doesn't. So it's but there's a little bit of storage capability. But generally, that intermittent factor, you have to be careful. We got a lot of comments about this. The higher the percentage gets. So what we did was we figure at 10% we'll be totally comfortable with that, with wind at 10% or renewables at 10%. Wind is 94% of that.
Wind is 94% of the 10% standard by 2015. Very interesting. Okay.
Well, we have a little bit of solar, we have a little bit of biomass, but basically it's onshore wind that has proven to be the most cost-effective source of renewable, so that's why that's been done in this time period.
I'm a little surprised by that figure, though, 94%. It really is dominated by the wind sector.
Yes, that is true. But we do want to be flexible. You know, costs can change over time, and we don't want to lock into, you know, just say, let's do wind forever. Because if there's another something else becomes more attractive economically, you know, we want to have the adaptability and flexibility to switch. So it is a renewable standard that can be met by any of those resources.
How does the rest of that 100% break down again? You said 94% of the 2015 standard will be hit with wind. How does the rest of that other 6% break down?
Yeah, it's 2% solar,
okay,
2% biomass, and 2% is all other, which includes like anaerobic digesters and some landfill gas.
Now, of those that comprise that 6%, which one is most promising there in your view? Is there a trend in play here that for another renewable energy source that could, over time, compete with this wind generation?
Well, I would talk about two. I'd talk about both biomass and solar. Solar costs have been declining. Technology's been improving there, too. The costs are still high. In our report, we reported solar cost about $144 per megawatt hour, which is a lot less than it used to be, but it's still not down in the range where wind is in the $50 to $60 range. Biomass is interesting too because we do have a lot of biomass resources in the state. We have harvesting of timber, and once the producers of timber and paper are done, there's some waste wood left over that could be used as fuel in a biomass facility.
In general, how much enthusiasm did you detect, though, for really a dramatic increase in the renewable portfolio standard?
We had a lot of interest in increasing. I'd say there was a lot of people on both sides of this issue. It was probably of the various issues we delved into, renewables, I would say, had the most activity from public comment, and it came on both sides of the issue.
And what did you hear from? Talk to us about what you heard from the utilities.
The utilities on renewables said that they believe that we can do some more renewables. We ought to do it cautiously, in the sense that, you know, let's do it. Let's have a plan. Let's do it at a pace that's manageable. But they were cautiously optimistic that we could do more.
Or are you overall, were you encouraged by the input that the utilities provided in the forums?
Yes, I think they did. They were very active participants, and they gave us a lot of valuable information.
Let's listen to a guest that we had on Current State here about a month ago. James Clift is the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. You're smiling like you're acquainted with Jim. And he makes the case for increasing the portfolio standard like this.
You look at our transition up to now, we've been adding about 1.5% a year. You know, we started at about 3 or 4%, and we're going to be up to 10% by 2015. So we're kind of on this track of slowly transitioning over to this renewable energy. We think that we can easily double that number. So I think, you know, continuing this transition at 1.5 to 2% a year for another 4 or 5 years would be a great next step for Michigan.
Okay, and your report actually suggests a 30% rate by 2035. So that would triple over the next 22 years. Up to 30% is feasible.
Yes, well, the 30% by 35 kind of implies in it a 1% increase year over year, so that would be a little bit less than what Mr. Clift had recommended, but it's certainly within the ballpark. So what I like about this report is it lays out the facts. The commenters can comment on it. We're going to prepare a final report because our current report is only a draft. But at the end of the day, Governor Snyder will make recommendations based on the report and all the comments to the legislature, who will be the ultimate decision makers in this process.
We're talking with James Quackenbush of the Michigan Public Service Commission about the forums conducted here so far this year and his final report on these the future of Michigan's energy sector. Beyond reporting on renewables, John, you also have compiled reports on efficiency programs and electric choice. Can you explain Michigan's electric choice law for starters?
Yes. Currently, Michigan has a hybrid system, which makes it somewhat unique in the nation. A lot of states are either have a deregulated market for electric generation, or some states fully regulate electric generation. We're in the hybrid where we allow competition, but only up to 10%. We have a 10% cap on it. So our utilities show characteristics of being fully regulated, yet also there's that 10% competition element.
And how does that play out in others? How do the standards end up playing out in other states compared to Michigan's? I mean, we're hitting 10% by 2015. You're saying 30 by 35 is reasonable. How is this playing out in other states?
Well, on the choice market, or in the choice area, there's not that many states that have a percentage in the middle. They're either all in or they're all out in general. Ohio is an example of a state that's making a transition from being regulated. They're at the tail end of becoming deregulated. States like Pennsylvania and Texas are all in. They're 100% in competition. A lot of the New England states are. A lot of the states that had high rates to begin with, we're looking for alternatives and sought out the deregulated marketplace. And so on the choice front, Michigan is one of the only ones that kind of sets up a partial target.
And how would you contrast the input that you got from ordinary citizens, ordinary Michigan taxpayers, with the input you got from the utilities with regard to the electric choice piece?
Well, I think the citizens are aligned with the utilities. Their large industrial customers in the state are the ones that are taking advantage of the choice, and they're getting lower rates currently. As we mentioned in our paper, those costs then get spread to the non-choice customers, which the private citizens, the person in the street, are the ones that are arguably bearing the cost for the industrial customers having this right to select a lower electricity rate.
I have to ask you a question that involves politics before we wrap this up. This discussion is picking up now. It'll continue through next year. How receptive is the current legislature, which will remain in place for more than another year? How receptive is this legislature to the kinds of changes that are contained in your report?
Well, it's kind of early to tell. Right now, I think they're going to take the governor's recommendations, which are likely to come in December, and spend a good chunk of 2014 debating, analyzing, holding some work groups, and perhaps be ready to take action in 2015.
And we should point out that Governor Rick Snyder is on the record as supporting an increase in the renewable portfolio standard as well. We want to thank John Quackenbush, chair of the Michigan Public Service Commission, for coming back to Current State. His new draft report on Michigan's energy future is available today. Go to michigan.gov/energy to check it out. John, thank you. Integrating humanities and science is what our next guest on Current State seeks to accomplish with her research here at Michigan State University. Dr. Natalie Phillips is the co-director and lead faculty member for Literary Neuroscience and History of Mind at the Digital Humanities and Literary Cognition Lab. She studies what happens in the human brain when a person reads. Her work offers a fascinating look into the complex processes of the brain and suggests the developmental impact of literature can be profound, and she joins us on Current State to discuss her research and her findings. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about what you do here in the Digital Humanities and Literary Cognition Lab? This sounds fascinating. You process or analyze what happens in the human mind when a person is reading.
Yes, that's exactly what we're beginning to do. And so the lab itself is a much larger structure. So just sort of co-founded with my colleague Steve Rockman, sort of forwarding a whole series of interdisciplinary projects in things like literary neuroscience, but also the history of mind and digital humanities. Our particular study, today I'll be talking about the current centerpiece of the lab, which was an interdisciplinary experiment I've been working on first at Stanford and now at Michigan State that uses technologies from neuroscience, specifically fMRI or functional magnetic resonance imaging and fMRI-compatible eye tracking to explore how our brain responds when we read a work of literature with different levels of attention. And here, it's actually when a group of PhDs in English read a novel by Jane Austen.
Fascinating. Why Jane Austen?
Jane Austen was an interesting choice. She is, one of the points of the study was to analyze the complexity of moving between two different levels of attention to reading. Close reading, which is a literary skill that's taught in the classroom that allows us to analyze or unpack the very structures that give a novel its richness and depth, and pleasure reading. And you can sort of imagine just sitting down and curling up with a good book. And Jane Austen, I happen to be an 18th centuryist, and Jane Austen is one of the few novels that still allows us to do both. You can imagine actually picking up a work by her off of the bookshelf and sitting down to read in an armchair for pleasure, but also studying in a literary classroom, assigning to a bunch of English majors or English PhDs to really unpack the richness of what she does.
How very interesting. Did you have a hypothesis? Do you have any kind of hypothesis going into this project?
I didn't in many ways. We expected to some degree to be seeing relatively, when I first began the study, actually, when I spoke with neuroscientists about it, we expected to see really minute and subtle changes in the brain in comparing these two forms of attention to reading Jane Austen. And their point was fairly straightforward. Everyone was going to be doing the same thing. They were all going to be reading this novel by Jane Austen, just in two different ways, reading for pleasure and then reading for literary analysis like you would in an English classroom. Because of this, we almost narrowed down to just focus on a very, very minute part of the brain just to see if we could see these incredibly subtle differences. Well, thank goodness we didn't. And because we acquired whole brain scans, what we've been seeing is, in fact, unbelievably diverse, almost global activations across the brain for most of our subjects, suggesting that literary analysis and one of the core skills taught in humanities classrooms across the country, in fact, is engaging and orchestrating diverse cognitive regions of the brain.
So does that suggest that in developmental terms, that the richest kinds of reading to pursue would be something with a more complex framework, but that at the same time has this more pleasurable payoff? That seems to be where you're going with
yes.
this.
Yes. One of my jokes is that in the pilot study, we actually had to eliminate professors. PhD students were perfect, but professors had actually forgotten how to pleasure read. And one of the things that this had suggested was, but as we began to look at the results more closely, what we're seeing is not only these unbelievably broad and again, really global activations for literary analysis, for close reading that we never far beyond what we would have expected, but also activations, an interestingly different set of neural signatures for pleasure reading, which really suggests the value of cognitive flexibility, of being able to sit down with a book and being able to modulate your attention, to be able to analyze a work of literature, but also still read it for pleasure, which suggests that professors probably have something to learn from being able to put the pencil down.
Who besides professors and PhD students would you like to study? I mean, are there more run-of-the-mill type non-academic people that you want to look at here?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This, just to say openly, this is really just the very beginning of this type of work. This is one of the first studies of literary reading that's been done inside an MRI scanner. And so we're really just at the tip of the iceberg. There are all kinds. I would love to do studies of everyday students. I've had people from law approach me and talk about comparing this to legal reading, reading all sorts of different novels, not just Jane Austen, but perhaps, you know, not just Pride and Prejudice, but Pride and Prejudice and zombies.
Right. Well, it seems to me there are other genres, too, that work in this same way, that I think of crime titles and mysteries as well that can be that really require some degree of analysis, but at the same time is pure pleasure for some people.
And this is one of the next stages, I think, of this research. There was a really interesting study that just came out that suggested that award-winning literary fiction, popular fiction like Danielle Steele or John Grisham, and nonfiction all created different sorts of empathetic reactions in the reader, and in fact improved their responses to certain tests of empathy known as theory of mind. And one of the things that you can begin to start thinking about in terms of this is that to ask not just how to divide these into really tight groups and genres, separating out the John Grisham from the Jane Austen, but in fact to say, yes, some literary works, a number of works, are going to always be requiring us to modulate our attention in these ways, demanding richer analysis and allowing a sort of ebb and flow through these stages of sort of richer absorption in reading, getting really lost in a good book, and then pulling back and stopping to analyze and to reflect on what we're reading. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the larger goals of the study is, in fact, because we're using both fMRI and fMRI-compatible eye tracking, as well as having students at the end write literary essays where delightfully, to my surprise and delight, they ended up quoting from material from the text that they weren't even seeing. We can begin to put that together to start producing a sort of really complex real-time sense of how the brain is changing as we read, not just sort of a broad-scale comparison between these two types of attention that you can bring to fiction.
Where are these MRI units that you use for your research? Where does that actually take place?
So the work that I've been doing actually began at Stanford and then came with me when I moved here to Michigan State. So because we're using fMRI-compatible eye tracking, all of the research has been done so far there at Stanford. But one of the things I'm really excited about is beginning to do this research at MSU. And probably one of the most exciting aspects has been working with a really cross-college initiative group of interdisciplinary scholars who specialize in all kinds of approaches to brain research. And we're looking at, it's really early so far, but the creation of a interdisciplinary brain institute at MSU that will allow for these kinds of interdisciplinary experiments where you have a PI in English and a co-PI in neuroscience and collaborators from linguistics, radiology, et cetera, to emerge and flourish down the road.
Have you thought about people who take pleasure in the more analytical thing? What about situations where someone is pleased? In other words, what they find pleasure reading really involves this more complex analysis, this where there isn't necessarily a real clear split between the two.
Absolutely. I think, again, that this is part of the exciting thing that this research is showing. You know, though you might have expected to see just pleasure centers activating for the more relaxed style of reading, you know, being lost in a good book, and regions associated with work, attention, and cognitive load, or for literary analysis, what we're seeing, again, is these diverse and widespread cognitive activations, which suggests, at its simplest form, the way I like to boil it down is to say that pleasure reading has its own challenges, and close reading has its own pleasures, right? It really reveals to us this this sophistication. Because we had students, our participants, write extended literary essays at the end as well, we can also begin to dig into something truly interesting, which is individual differences as well in people's responses to this literary work, and use that to begin to start mapping their attention as they move through the text.
Very interesting work being done here at Michigan State University. We thank our guest, Dr. Natalie Phillips, co-director and lead faculty for the Literary, Neuroscience, and History of Mind at the Digital Humanities and Literary Cognition Lab. Thanks for joining us, Natalie.
Thanks so much.
Good luck. Current state on WKAR, Target marketing is nothing new. From their cleaning products to fast food to pickup trucks, companies have been directing their advertising at certain segments of the population for ages. But when does Target marketing cross the line from just good commerce into perpetuating stereotypes about certain groups in our society? Our next guest says that the auto manufacturers are particularly egregious offenders of using stereotypes to market their products to minorities. Last Friday, Aaron Foley, a Detroit-based writer for Jalopnik, that's Gawker Media's popular blog on cars, wrote a post on the subject saying, quote, "As a minority, it's borderline insulting that automakers are overthinking this." Aaron Foley joins us now by phone from Detroit. Welcome to Current State, Aaron.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. Thank you. Let's start here with an example here that you cited. This is an ad for a Toyota Prius from a couple of years ago. It shows a Prius driving down a CGI animated road, and the car is towing the sun through pastel-colored fields, crowds, and streams. Here it is.
It gives the world fewer smog-forming emissions. It gives you a 50-mile-per-gallon rating. The third-generation Prius. It's harmony between man, nature, and machine.
So this is an example you cite that would be targeted more to a white audience. What jumps out at you about this?
One of the things that jumps out to me about it is the fact that, you know, the Toyota Prius is a hybrid car, and car companies want to market hybrid cars to people who are very conscious of the environment. I'm not necessarily sure it's a ad for white people, but it does explain, you know, in the quick 30 or 60 seconds of that ad, this is a hybrid, this is what a hybrid does, this is why a hybrid is good for the environment, this is why you should consider buying this car because you want to do something good for the environment. And that's what advertising should do, is if you're selling a car that's unique in the marketplace, that's different from a gas-powered car or something that we're traditionally used to, but you're trying to also sell this benefit, you know, it's got the imagery and the text behind it to explain why this is a good thing.
Well, let's listen to another ad that you use, another Prius ad that you cite as Exhibit A to show how car companies market differently to minorities, in this case African Americans. The ad features the singer Rafael Sadiq playing a guitar and singing in front of a red Prius on a white soundstage with three attractive African-American women dancing and sitting in the back seat.
Toyota Prius. Those who get it, get it.
Now, among the features highlighted in pop-up graphics are the estimated 50 miles per hour fuel economy, the multimedia system, and that it was named the best overall value for the last 10 years in a row. But you wrote, this ad really bothers you. What's going on here that bothers you?
It does, because if you listen to, if you contrast the Rafael Sadiq ad with the previous ad, listen to what Rafael Sadiq is saying. Does he say anything about the car itself? Does he say, here's how a hybrid works? Or is he singing anything about the benefits of the car? The other thing that sort of bothered me about it was it's a little too attractive. Like we mentioned, the three women sitting in the back seat, and cars are made for driving. You know, they're not made for to just be sitting in the back seat and dancing and singing. And the fact that this particular ad focused so heavily on the multimedia system, multimedia systems are not the only reason why people should be buying a car, and especially if you're talking about a hybrid, which has a different powertrain than a gas than a typical gas-powered car. Then why are you telling me? Why aren't you telling me more about how this car gets 50 miles per gallon on the highway, or why it's a good idea that this car gets 50 miles per gallon on the highway? Then you are telling us about how the music works, and why is there so much emphasis on music in this commercial? And I think the point that I argued was, if you looked at the YouTube comments on that video, everyone was more curious about Rafael Sadiq and the song and where they could download the song and where's the full version of the song. And there was no comments on the front page about, I'm interested in this car, I'd like to know more about this car.
So the car companies are getting it wrong, in your view, when it comes to marketing to minorities?
I think so, because if you looked at the past couple of years, it's not just car companies, but I think a lot of companies in general tend to focus more on style over substance, and they do rely on a lot of celebrities, particularly singers and musicians, and it sort of blurs the line between, are we looking at music videos, are we looking at real short clips, are we looking at advertisements for the work of the musician, or are we actually looking at the benefits of the product, which I think, all companies, they want to sell us things, they want to make a profit, but I don't think they're doing a good enough job of actually telling us what the benefits of the products that we're selling, and they're just thinking that people will buy it just because there's music in the ad. And I think it sort of dumps it down if you do it that way.
I want to make sure I understand your point. You're not saying that the car companies shouldn't market differently to different ethnic groups. You're saying that the imagery is not representative, and there's simply not enough information about the vehicles.
Right. There, I do think that a lot of the ads that are geared toward minorities don't have enough information. I think people nowadays, regardless of your background, the economy and all these other factors are forcing people to look differently at how they buy a car. They want to know the best value for your money, which cars get the most gas mileage, which cars will have the best resale value, things like that. And if you look at other advertising, there are things like that. I look at pickup truck ads, and they say you should buy the Chevy instead of the Ram or the Ford or something like that. A lot of pickup truck ads will emphasize things like towing numbers, fuel numbers, capacity, all those sorts of things. Whereas, going back to, targeted marketing, it's all about the music. It's all about people looking good. It's all about, this is a status symbol. This is an accessory rather than a necessity.
Well, with their ads, are the car companies saying something about, are they revealing what they think about minorities with their advertising?
I think they are. I think, I can understand it's a very tough spot for any company to be in. You don't want to disinclude people from advertising. You want everyone to be considered as a customer, but we've seen these types of ads for years upon years upon years, where it's always been a heavy emphasis on music, a heavy emphasis on style, and and image consciousness and things like that. But why is it that that's the only strategy that these companies use is to use music in advertising, to constantly use music in advertising? I think one of the examples someone noted in the comments on Jalopnik was, you know, it's always a smooth jazz playing in the background against an urban backdrop, and people are driving at night, and, you know, they pull up and, you know, they're looking, you know, dressed to the nines and whatnot, and you don't really know it's a car advertisement until the very last 2 seconds of the car, and the catchphrase will be, you know, like the Raphael Sadiq catchphrase was, if you get it, you get it. Well, what am I getting? You know, it's those sort of things that I wonder, is this the only strategy that car companies have?
What if they work, though? What if they're successful at selling cars to African Americans? I mean, have the car companies or has anybody in the advertising business said as much to you? Or I mean, would you anticipate that they would say something like that?
You know, the door is always open to dialogue. I mean, if they work, they work. But it sort of raises the question of why is it that this particular thing works? I mean, I would love to see the diagnostics and whatnot behind that, but it's a little bit bothersome that when you look at more mainstream advertising, and it does have a lot of technical information and more, you know, information of value, why hasn't that, you know, where's the bridge between that sort of advertising and the targeted marketing? Or why can't we see more of the type of advertising that we see geared towards the mainstream, that same style where we do emphasize the technical specifications and whatnot? Why can't we also see that in the targeted advertising as well?
Interesting discussion. Aaron Foley is a Detroit-based writer for Jalopnik, Gawker Media's popular blog on cars. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
No problem. Anytime.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we continue our election series with the Lansing 2nd Ward race, and Neighbors in Action features East Lansing's Haven House. That and more on tomorrow's show. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.